Music session number 18045, Real One.
The history of the regiment and the different regiments that were formed from 41 through to 45.
Just a rough outline from the start.
Yeah.
Well, the start, of course, was on the disbandment of the commandos that went to the Middle East, which was 8 commando, 11 Scottish, few of 7, and a few of 4 commando, that been in the Middle East for quite a few months, and they were highly trained men. The training in the commandos had been very, very rigid and up to a high standard. And they'd been messing about in the Middle East for months and going on operations and operations being called off at the last minute, going to do a landing at Tobruk, not getting anywhere. And so they were decided to disband them, the commandos. And everyone was sent back to their various bases. I went back personally to the Infantry Brigade headquarters, the IBD of the Guards, and of course they got their prize. They got all these guardsmen back that had been running around as commandos, and we were chased from morning to night, you know. And fortunately a Lieutenant Sterling, who had been in the Scots Guards troop of 8 commando, visited the base depot and asked for volunteers for a unit that he was going to form that was going to operate behind the lines in small numbers, as commandos had proved pretty useless operating in mass, and these small parties would operate behind the line and get German equipment, German aircraft. Parachuting would be involved, that he had so many volunteers, about 56 volunteers, that volunteered straight away to get away from the guards, you know, back to the old bull.
Can we go back a stage? How did you and the guards, tell me how you got into that and how you got into commando from there?
From the guards.
Yeah, you told the story.
I joined the Grenadiers when the war started, and went to Chelsea Barracks, where I was chased from morning till night. I don't regret any of the training I had at Chelsea, but I thought after weeks and weeks that I was getting absolutely nowhere, and I wanted to be involved in the war, as I'd just signed up for duration of war. So every time a thing came up on detail that they wanted volunteers for rear gunners in planes, gunners on trawlers, myself and a chap named Lofty Baker kept volunteering. And in the finish, the major said, if we volunteered again, we'd put in jail, and wanted to know why we wanted to leave the guards. Then the day came in about June 40 when Lofty Baker and myself were lying on the beds at Chelsea Barracks, and we'd heard talk about forming a guards commando. But we couldn't volunteer for it because we'd been ordered not to. And it was Wednesday afternoon, I remember well, because Wednesday was the relaxing afternoon, you know, the sort of hygiene in the barrack room, etc. And in came a Sergeant Major, who was known as Shithead Joy, and he said, Bennett and Baker, get down to the orderly room. And there was a great big queue of guardsmen and NCOs waiting, volunteering for the commandos. And we were taken straight up to the front in front of a major, and the sergeant major saluted and said, "This is Bennett and Baker," and he said, "You're off to the commandos," and that made their day. And we then went down to Burnham-on-Craige, where we started intensive training. A lot of the people that were lined up were asked if they could swim, drive, etc. But we were asked nothing, we were told to report. And then my soldiering started. I was happy in it, it was hard training. Very, very hard training. And from there, as I say, we went, when we were fully trained, we went off to the Middle East.
Which, as what commando were you?
As number 8, Guards Commando.
Which one was Stirling? Was he in?
He was in 8. Well? 8. He was Scots Guards. Right. I was Grenadiers, you see. We had each troop represented different parts of Guards. Number 1 was the Horse Guards. 2 troopers of Grenadiers. They went in seniority.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had Coldstream, Scots, Welsh. The whole Brigade of Guards represented.
What was the function of the commando that assumed that time?
The function was to go to the Middle East and do commando landings from whatever vehicles were going, you know, or vessels were going at that time. And we did one operation. We set out on to Tobruk on a destroyer called the HMS Decoy, and we never got anywhere. Everything we went on seemed to be cancelled at the last minute. Mm-hmm.
All that whole commando went up together, did it?
8 commando.
Yeah.
Yes.
What boat did you
operated
go
as? We operated from the.
When you actually went up from Britain to the Middle East.
We went out on the Glen boats, which were fitted up. The Glen Roy, Glen Hearn, and the Glen Gyle. They were fitted up with the flat bottom boats, the invasion boats, the Lanycraft LC, Lanycraft Infantry LC.
When did you go? When did you leave England for the Middle East?
That was about Christmas 1940.
Where were you based at then?
And we went to a place called Geneva in the Middle East, in Egypt, and set up base there.
So how long was it before then the commando was disbanded?
They were disbanded about June, I think, of that year. Mm. And the SAS, David Stirling came round, I think, the beginning of July, asking for volunteers.
Was Jock Lewis guard?
Jock Lewis was guard, yeah. He was Brigade of Guards.
What about Paddy Main?
Paddy Main was 11 commando.
Right.
The officers, going through the officers, you had David Stirling, Scots Guards, Jock Lewis, I think it was Welsh Guards, I'm not certain on that, you better check on that. Welsh Guards, Bill Fraser, who came from 11 Commando, Paddy Main, who came from 11 Commando,
why was it that all the operations, were they all called off, or did you ever plan to do any operations?
No, some of 8 Commando went to Tobruk when it was besieged and did quite a few operations. This was going on at the time that David Stirling was after volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
They did quite a good job up in Tobruk, doing patrols at night through the Loire and creating the menace to the enemy at Tobruk. That was in the time when it was siege.
Because some of them got very badly shot up in.
And 11 Commando were shot up, they went off to Syria.
Yeah.
11 Commando. Mm. They were pretty badly done up there. But most of the guards, as far as the guards commando in the Middle East, very little was done. And I think that David Stirling saw through the thing that this was old-fashioned sort of warfare, and what you've got to get, as he explained, you didn't have the aircraft in the Middle East to combat, you know, the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, and he got it into his head that with a few people you could do more damage by destroying planes with small numbers of people, with two and three at a time, by getting in behind the lines and putting bombs onto the planes. Going into the bomb part of it, Jock Lewis was made training officer.
I'm just testing to see if I'm trying on though, I can do it at the same time.
Jock Lewis was made training officer at the start of our detachment, and he was responsible for all training, and also took the job on of inventing a bomb.
Right, going back to after the commando was disbanded, mm-hmm. What happened to you then?
Oh, well, as I said, we went back to Geneva.
Yeah.
And we were just chased around by the guards, you know, went back to the guards' base depot.
Yeah.
And we weren't there very long before David Stirling came down for volunteers for this owl detachment.
Can you describe that to me?
What, when he came down?
Yeah.
But as I said, he visited the camp, and we were all called together, all the eight commando people, eight guards commando people, and he put the proposition to us that he was forming a unit that would operate behind the lines, and that he realised that commandos, everyone had been a bit disgusted because we'd got very little done in the commandos. We hadn't achieved very much, and he had this brainwave of small parties operating behind the lines in the desert. Various means of transport going in, parachuting came into it, although no one knew anything about parachuting in the Middle East at that time, and the people were so keen to join this unit. Number one, to get away from the guards, base depot, where we'd been chased to death every day, you know.
Did you know who Stirling was at the time?
Oh, yes. Well, we knew him as a lieutenant in the Scots Guards troop of 8th Commando.
Where did that meeting take place when he talked to people? Was that out in the open? Was that in a hall? Was that
I think it was in a big marquee, mm-hmm. If I remember right. We were all taken to a big marquee where, you know, everyone was kept head except them. The 8th Commando, ex-8th Commando people, and we were briefed on it in there.
He specifically went back to his own people?
He went back to number 8 Commando, yes.
Yeah.
8 Guards Commando. Mm. Then I think he went off from there to 11th Commando, you know, what was left of 11th Commando. They'd suffered quite a lot of casualties. And as I say, everyone volunteered, most people rather, volunteered from to go back. And we were put on 3-ton trucks the next day to a place on a canal called Cabrit. And the trucks pulled up and David Stirling said, well, this is it, the camp, and all we could see was a load of sand going down to the Suez Canal, and not a build, not a tent, nothing. And someone said, well, where's the camp? And he said, that's a first operation, you steal it. And we thought, well, you know, the type of chaps that you had were, loved it. And that was the first operation the SES did, was to go down in the dark of night to a camp near Cabrit that the New Zealanders were using, but they were up at the desert at the time. They were up in action, and the camp was empty, and so we were driven down there, and we stole tents, bars, three marquees, accommodation for the 56 people, and everything was set up. Piano, stole a lot.
There must have been some guards on that camp there. I mean,
there were guards, but they didn't seem to take a lot of notice. And someone, I can't remember who, said, turned round to one of the guards or one of the MPs, military police or something, said, what a racket this is, CO has us working all night, and joked it off, and we just picked up. The next day we had a perfect camp up at Cabrit.
Was there any selection process at that stage? Because you actually said there were...
there need not be really selection, because these were all highly trained men from the Guards Commando.
Right.
So there was no selection.
Right.
But then when the training started, you were told by David Sterling that if you didn't come up to scratch, you were out quicker than that. And as I say, there was never a more fit, in my opinion, never more fit assignment of troops in Egypt, because they were very highly trained. They'd had months and months of training, you know, and they were very, very good, very good troops. Now,
what was Cabrit like? What was the camp like?
Well, as I say, we stole this camp and put it up, and then got down to serious training. Jock Lewis put in charge of all the training, and at the same time there were bangs going off all over the camp. We were trained. We were doing route marches, initiative tests, all sorts of training.
Tell me about initiative tests. What sort of?
Well, more memory tests. I remember one of the tests, you'd walk into a tent and there'd be a table, which is a very important thing, memory, a table strewn with different articles, and you'd have half a minute in there, go out, and you'd memorise what articles were on the table. This was all for training the mind to keep map references in, etc., without carrying, you know, information on them. And the physical part was very, very tough. We did long route marches.
How long is long when you
Well, we started off at about 20 miles and we worked right up until the first operation to doing 100 miles from Cabrit to Cairo. That's straight across desert. No chance of any sort of supplies whatsoever except what you carried. We carried 4 bottles of water each. But going back to the training again, I'm missing a thing. The weapon training, we had a small range down on the canal, and unlike the rest of the British Army, where you were marched onto a range and you were given orders to, you know, to fire, etc., unlike that, you could go and draw weapons from the armoury at Cabrit, including foreign weapons, German Spitzers, etc. And you'd just wander off on your own down to the range and you'd test these different weapons. And then you chose your weapon. No one hollering and shouting behind you, you know. So you became a much better shot without people screaming over your shoulder. And you selected your weapon. Then the parachute training started, and as I say, no one knew had a clue about parachuting, and I think David Sterling sent off to Ringway to get instructors out to, they just started up parachute training in England, to get instructors to come and join us, and that was refused. And if I remember right, it was said that it wasn't practical to jump in the Middle East because of the air current. Some feeble excuse. Anyhow, they didn't send anyone out. And so he acquired the parachutes. he started the parachute training, Jock Lewis started the ground training, and we just had stands from about 10 foot scaffolding up to 16 foot, which we used to jump off of and do front rolls, side rolls, back rolls. And then they had a brilliant idea.
You're talking about the closure, or what sort of protective clothes did you wear? Tell me about that.
Oh yes, the clothing that we were issued with was the American baseball gear, the helmets and the knee pads, and I think elbow pads, which was pretty good, but we didn't use them long. And we had a small truck mounted on a platform that ran on rails, and two people got onto this truck. The rest of the lads pushed it as mad as they could, and you jumped off into two pits and did rolls from that.
Off the side, yeah.
Off of each side, yeah. Which you'll see in that film. Mm-hmm. You did rolls off of that. And then he had the brilliant idea of jumping off of 1,500 weight trucks, doing about 30 mile an hour. And that really fixed it. The chap said, well, we're having no more of this rubbish, because we had so many casualties in sprains. That was squashed straight away. There were quite a lot of accidents on it. And then came the day that the first parachute jump was going to be done. Now the thing with the planes they were using were Bristol Bombays that did 100 mile an hour flat out. They were the old peacetime soup carriers, and they did about 100 mile flat out an hour. The day came for the jump when half of the people went up in a Bristol Bombay. I was down on waiting for the second lot to go up. And we were standing watching the plane, and it circled the other side of the canal, circled the DZ, and I thought I saw something come out. And I said to Dave Kershaw, my mate, I'm sure something came out. He said, well, if it hadn't done, it would have had a parachute on it. And with that, the plane landed. And what had happened was that the first two chaps had jumped, a chap named Duffy and Warburton had jumped, and the static line hadn't been made correct, and the thing had slipped the hook, and they'd come down and were killed instantly. And although David Sterney had jumped before this from Lysanders, and Jock Lewis had been jumping before that, by Lysanders with no accidents, but they just had their things, apparently they'd had their static lines tied inside the Lysander. Well, you can imagine the sort of size that went up, and said, well, this is a right unit. The first two that go in get bumped off. So we were all moaning like hell. And the plane landed, and Jock Lewis came back and got the whole lot on parade and explained that Duffy and Warburton had been killed, and that it was due to the fact that the RAF had put the fittings of the Bristol Bombay, had given it to the Egyptians to do, and they hadn't done it maliciously at all, that they just made the hook where the hook didn't fit up. So what had happened, the hook from the static line, as the static line came out, just jumped over. And he said that this would be put right that night, that the RAF would make certain this job was done, and we'd be jumping in the morning. And so everyone went to their tents that night with 50 cigarettes and sat up all night smoking, weren't worried about the next morning. And he said anyone that wants to leave the unit is willing to go. And this is when I found out I was with a unit that meant something, because not one man backed out. And the next day, apart from people having a good pull at the static lines in the planes, every man jumped. And I knew I was with a unit then.
What's like going on to that? Tell me about the next morning. What happened the next morning?
In what way?
Well, what happened that morning?
We all jumped.
You went up in the first plane that morning? You were saying that you blacked out on the way down.
My first jump, yeah. What? As far as I was concerned, I gave the old thing a good tug, the same as everyone else did, and I jumped out, and I sort of blacked out until the parachute opened. I didn't know what had happened.
You got the back this, to you?
At the door.
Right.
At the side door. And we were jumping from 2,000 feet, and I pulled a mouth organ out and played it on the way down and thought it was wonderful world, you know. This parachute, it was nothing. And it took quite a time to get down from 2,000 feet. But strangely enough, with parachuting, the next jump you do, you realise everything that's happening, and it's not so good. And I never did become accustomed to parachuting. Every parachute jump I did, I never loved it. The one I did like was the first one I did. But after that, I never did like parachuting a lot. That's the strange thing about it.
What officers went up in the plane that morning?
The whole unit jumped. Everyone. From David Stern and all the officers, every man in our detachment.
Can you remember who the first people out were?
I can't remember. I think Jock Lewis. And knowing Jock Lewis, I must be right on that, because he was that type of man. Although he'd done jumps with David Stern before, he would have made sure that he'd go out first time that time. Yeah, the officer would have been the first to go out.
Were you relieved at all?
Oh, I was as happy as anything to get down on the deck after seeing W. Warburton crashing, yeah. That was terrific. And then, of course, the old morale went right up, you know.
What did Jock Lewis look like? Just the details.
Jock Lewis was a slim, very good-looking chap, little tash. And he was a stroke for Oxford pre-war. And Tommy Langdon, who was 8th Commando, who went to SBS, was stroke for Cambridge. So they knew each other very well. But he was a very, very smart person, Jock Lewis, and a terrific character.
Again, just for casting, what sort of accent did he have?
Well, you could put it down to a college accent.
Mm. What about Sterling?
Same. Mm.
He's a big bloke, isn't he, Sterling?
Oh, you've got 6 foot. Mm. That's 6 foot 4.
Was Paddy Mayne at that stage, obviously?
Oh, yes, Paddy was in from the start, yeah. Oh, Paddy had been recruited by David Sterling from 11th Commando, where he'd been involved with trying to shoot his CO or something.
There was a story that David picked up in the prison, wasn't
there? It was. He was in close arrest. Yeah, he was in arrest when David picked him up and he said he would take him, but he was a CO and Paddy would do as he was told, you know.
Because David's also saying that Jock Lewis was at Tobruk for a while.
That's it, some of 8th Commando went to Tobruk.
And he tried to get Jock a couple of times. That's and Jock it. Said he had his own thing as well.
And Pat was up there with Jock Lewis, Pat Riley.
Really?
Yeah, he was up with Jock Lewis up at Tobruk. And he tried to get Jock down quite a few times, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's it. And then going back to Jock Lewis, of course, at that time, the only explosive you had in the Middle East was Noble's 808, which stunk terrible, which was like a plasticine, that would explode. But David Sterling wanted something that not only exploded, that would ignite once the thing went off. And he got Jock Lewis working on this, and all you could hear around the camp when you weren't out training was bangs all over the place of Jock Lewis trying these bombs out. And eventually he came to the answer that if you mixed thermite from the incendiary bombs, the thermite powder, mix that with the Nobles 808 and roll it all up together, you could put that, they put it on a petrol container and it did the job as soon as it exploded, so the petrol ignited. And this became known as the Lewis bomb. Of course, you've got plastic today that does it, you know, automatic. But that was the first bomb that had been designed in the army that would ignite, you know, on detonation. Mm. And that became known as the Lewis bomb, and it weighed about